The address that follows was delivered at a two-day convocation in Los Angeles in December 1963, climaxing the 10th anniversary year of the Fund for the Republic. The speaker, the Honorable Thurgood Marshall, was counsel in the historic school segregation cases of 1952 and 1954, and is now a judge of the United States Court of Appeals, Second Circuit. Judge Marshall discussed the role of the federal courts in realizing democracy's twin goals of liberty under law and equality before it. Judge Marshall.
What I have to say today is based on what I consider to be the role of the judiciary in our government, to throw it open and see where we are. And in doing so, I will have no striking new insights to offer, I find, but my hope is to point up some of the ways in which the courts have in the past and may continue in the future to contribute to the realization of our society's twin goals of liberty under law and equality before it. The first point is the extent to which the federal courts are now wholly free to engage in the task of molding a freer or more democratic society. In the lower federal courts, our task in the overwhelming majority of cases is to give effect to the wishes and intentions of the bodies which enacted the laws which we must apply, so far as we can discern them. Where the question is of state law, we must look to the state legislatures, the state court decisions. Where a federal law, we must seek to ascertain what Congress would have us do in the cases where the action involves statutory construction, subject, of course, to the binding interpretations of the Supreme Court on those matters in cases where even the federal law is primarily judge-made. We are bound also by the Supreme Court decisions. As a colleague on my court, Judge Henry Friendly, pointed out last year, the unsystematized profusion of federal statutes governing a great variety of matters, and the often confusing and indeed imprecise language in which they are framed, create enough problems of interpretation to keep any judge well occupied and well frustrated without his ever getting a chance to deal with more transcendent matters. I do not minimize the discretionary element which is involved in any judicial formulation of a rule of law, whether or not in the guise of statutory interpretation, because to do so would ignore what every important legal thinker has been saying for the past four decades. General language such as that contained in a statute can never be said with absolute certainty to apply to a particular case. The ambiguities are inescapable, and to receive them, the judge must often look to his own values and his own concept of a better society, as well as the manifestation of intent on the part of those who frame the general law. A reverend predecessor of ours on the circuit court bench, the great Judge Learned Hand, stated that when a judge tries to find out what the government would have intended, which it did not say, he puts into its mouth things which he thinks it ought to have said, and that is very close to substituting what he himself thinks right. Nobody does this exactly right. Great judges do it better than the rest. It is necessary that someone shall do it if we are to realize the hope that we can collectively rule among ourselves, the end of the quote. In many instances, the interests which a judge will take into account are included among the democratic concepts, but they are not the only interests to be weighed, and they are not always found except on which I think is an erroneously broad view of that term. To take a concrete example, I don't think we can say that the notion of a more equitable distribution of risk of personal harm in industrial operations, which lies at the foundation of the many federal court decisions liberalizing the rules which govern recovery for personal injury, has anything in the world to do with democracy or liberty, though it has much to do with one's concept of a fairer society where a man gets a fair shake. Furthermore, it is important to remember that in all the areas where we act, so to speak, as the agents of Congress or some other body, our determinations, insofar as they constitute rules of law, are subject to reversal at its instance. This point is obvious when the question is one of statutory interpretation. But it is less obvious, but equally true, in many cases which involve constitutional interpretations. For example, a great body of law has grown up under the authority of the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, restricting the powers of the states to regulate business, which has interstate characteristics. These cases have often held state laws invalid as an intrusion on reserved federal authority, which is paramount even though there is no applicable federal regulation. Yet Congress could, if it wishes, reject this entire approach simply by passing enabling legislation pursuant to its expressed power under the same clause. Another example of this are the cases more famous than numerous in which the courts have refused to sanction acts done under the express command of the president. The most noteworthy example is the Steele seizure case, in which both federal district courts and the Supreme Court held President Truman's seizure of the Steele mills unconstitutional. Had the seizure been authorized by congressional legislation, there could be no question of its legality. Without such sanction, the president was simply an officer acting without legal authority and as such subject to judicial correction under principles established since the time of the reaction and perhaps longer. Having said this, I must, of course, hastily add that under the American system of constitutional government, there are areas in which the courts do have an obligation to make an independent and binding decision that governmental power may not be exercised in certain cases, regardless of the fact that legislative approval has been given the challenged acts. Here we get into the difficult problem of judicial review, with all it implies as a qualification of the principle that the majority acting through its elected representatives ought to be able to effectuate its desires. I have no desire to enter into the debate over the justification to be found for this peculiarly American institution, which has been the subject of fruitful discussion in recent years by such judicial giants as former Justice Robert Jackson, present Justice Hugo Black, retired Justice Felix Frankfurter, Judge Learned Hand, and such scholars as Eugene Rostow, Herbert Wexler, Charles Black, Alexander Bickel, and others, to name but just a few of them. Let me simply say that, like all these men, I believe that the case for the propriety of federal judicial invalidation of state legislation is unassailable as a matter of constitutional logic, textual exegesis, and history itself. It would be impossible to maintain a system of supreme federal law demanded by our Constitution without a means of ensuring a uniform interpretation of that same federal law throughout the states. The only practical means of assuring this result is by providing access to a federal forum which can finally resolve all questions of interpretation. It is precisely this aspect of judicial review which is constantly under attack in the most vocal manner. I find it difficult to believe that any of the opponents have ever given any slight attention to the consequences of their position. If any have, I find it difficult to believe that their arguments are made in good faith. With regard to judicial review of federal enactments, I feel that its legitimacy, if not absolutely assured, is certainly strengthened by the fact that both the original Constitution and the Bill of Rights contain express prohibition of certain laws. If these laws are to be regarded as anything more than mere exhortation, it seems to me that the courts have a strong claim to be able to give them the force of law in appropriate instances. This process will inevitably result in some instances of so-called judicial supremacy and is not strictly compatible with the usual pattern of representative government. But where the power is exercised in the name of personal liberty, the price is never too high to pay. Protection of the great values set down in the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, as they have come to be interpreted, in a task of sufficient importance in our society that some interference with the will of the legislature done in a prudent and principled manner can and should be tolerated and expected. These remarks thus far have been directed to the general question of the court's role, important though limited, in affirming, furthering, and promoting the values we most cherish. Now, I've yet to say anything about how this function is exercised in actual cases. Consequently, I would like now to discuss a few of the specific areas, and the courts, especially the Supreme Court, have in recent years been instrumental in deepening the understanding and promoting the acceptance of values which are of crucial importance in our democratic tradition. In an article in the recent edition of Atlantic Monthly, my colleague Judge Irvin R. Kaufman has identified and discussed four of the areas in which recent Supreme Court decisions have had most important influence in this process. He cites the decisions regarding racial segregation, legislative apportionment, religious activity in public schools, and procedural due process in state criminal procedures as major examples. Add to this list the court's numerous decisions interpreting the First Amendment guarantees of freedom of expression, and I suppose we have a fairly complete catalog of the areas in which judicial decisions have been most influential in the continuing struggle to preserve and promote individual liberty and equality of all under the law. Of course, we must distinguish the racial equality and reapportionment decision from the school prayer and criminal law decisions on the ground that in the first two areas, the court decisions might be said to reflect an already existing widespread consensus, and something ought to be done about the matter, which was not being done by any other branch of the government. For various unsatisfactory reasons, while in the second group, the court's opinions have not been crystallizations of public opinion, but rather attempts to guide and mold it. The court serving not as a voice of contemporary opinion, but as a voice of communal conscience, as in Chief Judge Hughes' phrase, quote, teaches to the citizenry, end quote. I should like now to explore the same detail two of the other areas, racial equality and state criminal procedures. My reasons for selecting these are twofold. First, I am rather familiar with them as a result of a career in the past. And second, the standards and approach of the court are more clearly defined by virtue of the large number of cases which have been decided. At this time, when such attention is paid, most properly and justly so, to what lies ahead in the struggle for equality, it is proper to look back to the road already traveled. Just 25 years ago, in the State of the Union where most Negroes then lived, their lives were constricted by a whole series of state-imposed and fostered laws and regulations designed to foreclose them from participation and the political process and to erect high barriers to the attainment of any sort of social or economic or political equality. Actuated by a statesmanlike conception of the Equal Protection Clause as a guarantee of true equality in the eyes of the law, which thus prevents the use of race as a principle of discrimination among citizens, the federal courts, and nearly they alone, completely removed the legal justification for any form of state-required, state-supported, or state-inspired racial discrimination. The result obtains whether the locus is voting in primary elections, education at any level, interstate or local transportation, public recreation facilities, or facilities on any state property. To be sure, the illegality of the practice of school discrimination, to take the most conspicuous and most important example, has not yet led to statistically significant progress toward desegregation in any area. This phenomenon is to be accounted for by the necessity of bringing suit before the districts in many states will begin desegregation. By the room for delay built into the decree in the Brown case, by the evasive and dilatory, often disparately defiant tactics adopted by many state officials and local school boards, and by certain reluctance on the part of some Negro citizens to jeopardize their own position by moving vigorously to upset the established social order. I am happy to say that this last factor especially is of rapidly diminishing importance, particularly among the young, as the newspaper headlines almost every day confirm. And the federal courts in the affected states are less and less tolerant of delay. Although the road ahead is still long and rocky, I think there can be no doubt of the ultimate destination. What is even more important than the specific progress in eradicating these barriers to the achievement of racial and political equality is the impetus which the courts have given to the broad-scale assault on all forms of racial discrimination, private as well as public in character, north as well as south in location, which is now in progress. It is a commonplace, nonetheless true for being common, that more progress has been made here in the less than 10 years since the Brown decision than in the century before. What makes one uneasy, of course, is the truly awesome magnitude of what has yet to be done. It should be erroneous to claim that the progress thus far, and the progress which I, for one, believe we shall see in the future, is wholly the result of the stronger meaning given the Equal Protection Clause by the federal courts in litigation concerning it. A broadly based consensus has existed for some time that the amelioration of the condition of Negroes and other minority groups is one of the great unfinished pieces of social business for Americans. It remains true, however, that in a society where language of a written constitution enjoys such overwhelming dignity, the impetus which the courts have given to transforming a moral duty into a constitutional imperative is of great importance and value. Turning now briefly to the question of de facto segregation and the function which litigation in the federal courts may have in combating it, I will hazard only a few observations. Because it is rooted in widespread habits and attitudes, it cannot be overturned by judicial decrees as readily as the naked language of statutes and ordinances. The problem is obviously far less susceptible to legal correction than was legally enforced segregation. This is especially true as a federal constitutional matter, for the 14th Amendment, as you know, pertains only to actions by the states. On the other hand, in a great many areas, policies of segregation can be enforced only through the aid of legal protection extended by the state, and in other areas, of course. Persons who discriminate have received access to the state-conferred benefits. Under the extended view of state action in the restrictive covenant cases and others, which prohibits the employment of a state power to sanction private acts of discrimination, a considerable segment of private activity may be encompassed within the 14th Amendment prohibition. Should the Supreme Court reverse the convictions in the sitting cases now pending before it on the constitutional ground argued by the petitioners, the amendment range would be yet broader. To sum up, I do not think that the usefulness of litigation founded in the Constitution has been exhausted by whatever victories that have come so far, though there is no gainsaying the fact that a far larger role must be played by legislative, executive action, and public persuasion if the injustice and social waste inherent in racial discrimination are to be eliminated. Comparison of the federal court's work in fostering the fair conduct of state criminal proceedings with their work in forging the Equal Protection Clause into a meaningful weapon in the struggle against racial inequality involves a number of similarities and a number of important differences. Among the similarities are the far from accidental circumstance that both are largely products of the modern era in constitutional adjudication. When emphasis has shifted dramatically from the protection of business enterprises through government restriction to the protection of what I usually termed human rights. Again, in both cases, the courts have been asked to weigh claims put forward in the name of the Constitution by litigants whose strength in the popular political arena has usually been quite weak. The meaning of this is obvious in the case of racial discrimination. In the criminal area, I don't mean to suggest that a trial is in any way a political function, but simply to point out that the federal courts, in exercising a continuing scrutiny over the processes of state justice, will generally be involved in a publicly thankless task. This suggests, however, a point of important difference between the two areas. There is nothing inherent, especially in the American system, which demands the permanent exclusion of Negroes or any of the group from political power. And indeed, we see today a steadily growing and increasing trend toward their full participation in the rights and duties of citizenship. On the other hand, the cause of persons accused of crime, however much protection it may receive in legal theory, is inherently one that is unattractive to the popular mind, and the rights they receive are in constant danger of erosion. This is particularly true in the United States, where, regrettably, a pattern of public tolerance of brutal police practices, mob violence, grossly unfair trial procedures has existed in many areas, and as a sort of dark underside to the noble pronouncements of the Bill of Rights. Yet I think there are few who would deny that an impeccably fair process of criminal justice is one of the values that lies closest to the core of any free society, simply because the power asserted by government against a charged criminal is so great as to dwarf any other it exercises. Chief Justice Warren put the matter well in a recent case when he said that when society acts to deprive one of its members of his life, liberty, or property, it takes its most awesome steps. No general respect for nor adherence to the law as a whole can well be expected without judicial recognition of the paramount need for prompt, eminently fair, and sober criminal law procedures. The methods we employ in the enforcement of our criminal law have aptly been called the measures by which the quality of our civilization may be judged. And ends that quote. Further, if the words, "Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law," mean anything, they must surely seem to refer at least to criminal trials and demand the formulation of federal standards of due process. Surely it is not much of a distance from this to the idea now firmly fixed in our law that due process means fundamental fairness at every stage of a criminal proceeding. Influenced by those circumstances and by the idea that certain provisions of the Bill of Rights are themselves declaratory of an inherent in the motion of our fundamental fairness, the federal courts must again follow the Supreme Court. Among the most important principles are those that an accused may not be convicted through the use of a confession found to be involuntary, through the use of evidence obtained through an illegal, unreasonable search and seizure, and neither conviction based on knowingly perjured testimony or false testimony, nor corrected at the trial, nor one where the prosecution has suppressed material evidence favorable to an accused. None of these instances may such a conviction stand. Nor, of course, is a conviction constitutionally valid where racial discrimination has influenced the composition of either the grand or petty jury. Under the important recent decisions, an indigent person must be provided trial counsel unless he affirmatively and intelligently refuses it. We have also had indication from the Supreme Court that in some cases, at least where important federal rights are claimed, question where there is evidence to support a verdict and whether error in the admission of evidence may be deemed harmless are federal questions. This last point was raised by the Supreme Court just last Monday. In addition to the formulation of standards of fair play under the Due Process Clause, an important area of judicial concern has been the assurance of an opportunity of indigent defendants to obtain the exact same measure of justice in such matters as appeal and state post-conviction remedies as those who are able to pay the highest counsel fees that can be paid. Paralleling this development of a defendant's constitutional rights at the trial and appeal stages has come an expansion of the way in which the federal question may be raised. The chief instrumentality, of course, is the writ of habeas corpus, which by statute may be sought by persons alleging that they are in custody in violation of the Constitution. It has been clear far above more than a decade that the federal courts on such writs may consider federal questions even if the state courts consider them at the trial. And in order to determine the correctness of these, the federal court shall look into the record. Recent decisions have gone further in assuring the prisoner of all of the protection of these constitutional claims. Now, the reasonable men certainly can and do differ over the correctness of a decision, say, that a particular confession was obtained under circumstances amounting to mental or psychological coercion. Indeed, over the general advisability of the system, which seems to set up an almost independent system of review. Ideally, of course, the state courts themselves should have the primary responsibility for ensuring that criminal defendants receive treatment in accordance with the federal Constitution. However, so long as this is not always so, and I intend no disrespect whatever to the many state court judges who are conscientiously striving to dispense the full measure of justice to which criminal defendants are entitled, I believe the balance between finality and justice have been properly struck. Personal liberty is too vital a thing to be subject to deprivation except in accordance with the highest possible standards of fairness and decency. The record of the federal judiciary in the area of criminal law enforcement, both federal and state, may be viewed as the most striking example of its greatest function, the protection of individual liberties against encroachments of government power. One of the highest achievements is surely that we have seen fit to establish and further this institution of deliberate self-restraint within the governmental process. It is more important for the courts to continue this work in an era when both home and abroad individual freedoms are placed in increasing jeopardy by virtue of the pressures of a mass society.
You have been listening to Judge Thurgood Marshall discuss the role of the federal courts in realizing democracy's twin goals of liberty under law and equality before it. Judge Marshall's address was delivered before a two-day convocation in Los Angeles, which climaxed the 10th anniversary year of the Fund for the Republic. A printed version of Judge Marshall's talk has been published by the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in a pamphlet titled The Mazes of Modern Government. The pamphlet also includes papers prepared for the convocation by Governor Leroy Collins, Secretary of Agriculture Orville L. Freeman, Senator Hubert H. Humphrey, Newton N. Minow, and Admiral Hyman G. Rickover. If you would like a free copy of this pamphlet, please write Box 4068, Santa Barbara. Ask for The Mazes of Modern Government. This is Hal Kaufman speaking from the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara.